Welcome, ladies and gents, to the lighter side of genocide. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You can also join us in the chat room at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. If you use an NSA search engine and search for Vinnie Eastwood chat, like Google, it should work pretty easily. Today we have a guest called Keith Hunter. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Now, you call in from the Uber Kingdom there. I'd love you to just explain a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, I'm an independent researcher, and I suppose like many people who have got involved in the areas like, well, the esoteric sciences, if you will, or alternative history, or alternatives in so many areas with respect to looking at things like UFOs, looking at those kinds of mysteries, megalithic structures. I got involved in, you know, looking at these subjects now some 15 years or so ago. And I suppose in part, like many people, it's many of the Hollywood movies like Stargate or even The X-Files, those kinds of series. I think some people watch those and, you know, they're just interesting, and other people are inspired by them and think there's a real mystery here. And so they try to look deeper into it and wonder, is there a real truth to this? Is there really a cover-up? Are there advanced technological civilizations that existed before recorded history? Are UFOs real? ET contact? And I really got into this field 15 years ago, and my focus, if you will, my primary angle was on ancient measurement systems and looking at the megalithic structures, like the Great Pyramid and Stonehenge. And I was in particular intrigued by some of the astronomical side of things, such that, you know, some of the mythologies of the ancient Greeks and so forth, they give all these stories about the gods and so forth, but they really, you know, accord many of them for celestial changes and planetary interactions and these kinds of things. And there was one particular story, for example, if I'll just cite it as an intro, and that is the story regarding the Earth once having precisely 360 days per year. Now, this is the basis of degrees in angular measure, right? And currently the Earth's orbital
period, isn't it 360?
Yeah, 360 degrees in angular measure.
But we've got 365 days.
Yeah, this is what I'm coming on to. The Earth year currently is about 365.24218. It's just under 365 and a quarter. And if you looked at the ancient Egyptians, for example, they had a calendar which was based upon a combined 360-day year with a 30-day moon month. And they were of the view that once upon a time, the Earth did really have 360 days precisely, and simultaneously the moon had 30 days for the month, and currently it's just under 30 days. And so this got me thinking, has there been a real change from 360 to the current value?
I've got something to say in here. I was just watching an episode of Futurama last night, you know, by the maker of The Simpsons. And it gets on this premise of this global warming episode, and apparently it's all these robots that are really, really, you know, polluting and stuff like that. They're the problem. And in order to solve this global warming problem, they got all the robots on the Galapagos Islands to open up all their exhaust vents and point them straight up, and the resulting thrust from it actually pushed the Earth further away from the sun and gave it a whole extra week to the Earth's cycle, and they called it Robot Party Week.
Well, the ancient Egyptians, they called the five extra days unlucky when they were tagged on to the end of it. And their story was, and again, it's one of these weird mythological stories, the sun god heard that the sky goddess, Neut, would become pregnant and that her children would depose him. So the sun god Ra cast this curse on Neut that she could not give birth on any day of the year. So this wisdom god, Tota, played a game of draughts with the moon and won from the moon a measure of its light. And this had the effect of making the moon weaker and smaller in the sky. and it had to periodically go into hiding, and it could only give out its light in phases, which is what we have right now. And as a result, the moon moved away from the Earth, and the Earth itself swelled up in pregnancy, right? And it increased its number of days. And these five extra days allowed Newt to give birth, and they are symbolically her five children. And again, this is one of these mythological stories which, on the face of it, it seems like a nonsense. But what I was intrigued to really look at was, are there any scientific laws, physical laws, that astronomers might look at and say, yes, we can prove it? And there is. There was a really elegant breakthrough that I made in this area. And this is essentially what I wrote up in my book, but it's also my website, and it presents the key proofs that basically show there are laws of proportion, physical astronomical laws, very precise mathematically, that allow you to essentially back-transform the current Earth system so that the Earth did once have 360 days per year, and the Moon simultaneously did have 30 days per month. And there are many areas. I even reconstructed the solar system and looked at other planets as well. And you see, what you find when you look at the planets, especially just not just the Sun and the Moon and the Earth, you find that there are so many physical dimensions which are all ever so slightly out of harmony. I mean, for example, the distance between the Earth and the Moon, right, the mean distance, the semi-major axis, is almost dead on 60 times the radius of the Earth. It's about 60.29, I believe. But, you know, we have heard of the base 60 system, the Sumerians and Babylonians, right? And they go up in progressions of 60. And these form our angular measures. So if we had 360 degrees, we multiply that by 60, we get 21,600. And this is minutes of arc, 1/60th of a degree. And if we multiply minutes by 60, you know, the next progression up is the number 1,296,000, and that's seconds of arc. And again, when you look at this then, you can see that there's so many things slightly out of harmony. And on minutes of arc, you know, the key number of the sequence is 216. Well, it's almost the case that, again, if you take the radius of the Sun, it almost fits in dead on to the radius of the Earth orbit, 216 times, right? But it's not quite. And all of these values are all slightly out of harmony. You can even look at the table of elements. The highest melting point of the greatest element in terms of elements is carbon, right? The melting point of carbon is about 3,550 degrees. It's very close to 3,600 degrees. And you can show that the ratio of change is very similar there for carbon as the reverse of the Earth's increase of its year, right, from 360 to its current value. So I was looking at all of this area and trying to determine whether or not there is some sort of ideal system of measures that applies to the Earth, to the Sun, to the Moon, and are these changes real? And I did hit upon the key breakthroughs, and these are what I discuss in great depth in my book, The Lost Stage of High Knowledge. And when I basically came up with these critical links, I again found that this kind of ancient system of measures and ratios is actually very advanced physics that has the potential to allow you to trigger nuclear explosions, forecast earthquakes, or even engage in matter transfer between different celestial bodies. Some of this stuff goes into the highest realms of classification for military discoveries, which are kept suppressed from the public. And this
one thing would occur to me that perhaps the military didn't actually discover those methodologies on their own. Maybe they were just trying to reverse engineer something they found.
I think to an extent you're right. And I actually do think that what they have done is rediscover the science of the ancients. They realize, I think it's one of these things which in the mainstream it's not taught, but it's well known to people who look into it that there's a whole level of suppressed history, that there was indeed a great civilization global in nature that existed prehistory, maybe 12,000 years or so ago, right? And many of these great megalithic monuments that we have, if you study them carefully, and there are many researchers who have, like Christopher Dunn, who wrote the Giza Power Plant, and you look at some of the work of like Robert Bovall, Graham Hancock, there are many others, and they've looked at these monuments, and they realize that these are basically technological devices, very high-tech devices, and that the civilization...
Well, they're both that, and they must have been built with very high-tech devices as well. I mean, have a look at the Sphinx. It's like one stone. One stone. The whole thing.
Yeah, that entire complex, when you know, you've got your three Giza pyramids and then you've got the Sphinx, the whole thing. I mean, the engineering work, it's been studied by modern engineers, and they will say there are certain aspects. I believe one study was about the concrete between the blocks on the Great Pyramid, saying that we couldn't replicate this at this present moment. There's been a few studies like that. There's been other studies to show that the actual scope of building it, you know, it was vast, and this idea that it was made by just brute force labor and copper chisels, it appears to be a total nonsense. And you're right, the high civilization must have constructed it.
Can I ask, have they found huge amounts of dead slaves around the pyramids? Because I'm cognizant of how much of a phenomenon that became after discoveries at the Great Wall of China, that in order to build such an enormous monument with a slave labor force, you literally had to work millions of them to death. Is there anything like that anywhere near the pyramids that's been found?
I'm not certain about that. I think there are some sites where, again, it's I think it was his name, is it Zahi Hawass? He was on the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and I think he did some documentaries discussing about the workers. And I'm not sure how many graves or whatever, but I think there was something about it. But I've seen some time-based studies that have been done by engineers, and they were looking at, you know, the Egyptian year, like how often do you get people working, how many do you need, you know, per day, how many hours are they working, and then look at how much stone and the whole thing. And there were one study, I think, said something like it'd take like 27 years working at maximum capacity every day with no labor strikes or anything like that. You know, nothing. It was just to even get that with cranes, more, you know, just as advanced as we've got here, and the whole works. And, you know, I think the thing about it is you've got, on the one hand, the orthodox Egyptologists talking about copper chisels and, you know, basic stone tools. But if you put the specification for this monument in front of modern-day builders and engineers, they laugh at the theories of the orthodox Egyptologists. They laugh at them. You know, they say they don't know anything about construction to come up with these ideas. And it's all ideas.
Isn't that funny how you'll accuse somebody of knowing nothing about construction when they obviously have, and you can see it right in front of you, know it a hell of a lot better than you do?
That's the thing. I mean, the idea, one of the things that construction, you know, engineers talk about is this idea of scaling up. And just because you may know how to build something at a small scale, if you try building it at a larger scale, it doesn't mean that the same equipment and the same tools can do it. You know, it requires more advanced dynamic knowledge about materials and, you know, just to even make that occur.
Yeah, but yeah. It's like this. What are you speaking through to me right now? A computer. Would you ever, in a million years, trapped in a forest, be able to replicate that technology with your current knowledge? There's no freaking way.
Yeah. I mean, let me give you just a few bits and pieces of it. These are some of my discoveries regarding the Great Pyramid as well. And we right now have got a highly advanced model of the Earth. It's a slight ellipsoid, a slightly squashed sphere. And it's the WGS-84 model, which means World Geodetic System. It's 1984. We've got very precise dimensions of it, right? And if you were to... Remember I said that the Earth year, the Egyptians held that it had increased from 360 to its current value? Well, if you take the latitude of where the Great Pyramid is, specifically, it's 29 degrees, 58 minutes, and 51 seconds of arc north. And if you use our most advanced model, and you work out the small circle circumference, right, at that latitude of the Earth, and divide it by the elliptical arc from the equator up to that latitude, the ratio you get is almost dead on 10 times the ratio of change of the Earth's tropical year.
Well, hold on, we'll have to continue with more of this after the break. Keith Hunter is my guest, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after this break. Please join us in the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, live streams at americanfreedomradio.com. Invite some other people, because I got a feeling this is going to be a really interesting interview. Back in a minute.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream, just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president, it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go, in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Bill Hicks there. The fabulous, the illustrious, and fantastic Bill Hicks. And I would highly recommend listening to him, okay? And I'm not joking here, although he's a comedian. You've got to listen to Bill Hicks. A lot of it too. He's done. There's a couple of albums out there. People have uploaded stuff to Google Video, YouTube, that sort of stuff. He's kind of like, I don't know how you'd say it. Let's say if I was born in America, and let's say I was a hardcore smoking, drug taking, extremely angry person who just basically was the funniest frack in the world. That's kind of like Bill Hicks. Because I've modeled myself very much on his comedy and his perspectives of the world. And it's like, it's who woke me up, essentially. It was so funny, so insightful, and so real at the same time that it kind of breached all my barriers. I used to love the establishment. I used to want to be one of the heads of it. I won speech competitions and stuff like that supporting the establishment. This is something that everybody needs to expose themselves to. A little bit of Bill Hicks. Straight up. Keith Hunter is my guest from ancient-world-mysteries.com. If you search for him, he's not terribly high up on the Google ranking, so we're gonna try and change that. It's another thing that I do on the show every day, ladies and gentlemen, is I put up 4 YouTube videos of the interview. Audio archives on thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, and also audio archives up on Guerrilla Media, and what American Freedom Radio does, they put it up on AFR.com and stuff like that. The whole idea is here. We've got a whole bunch of activists, a whole bunch of researchers, a whole bunch of knowledge out there that just ain't recognizable, okay? We've got to put them out there as often and as much as humanly possible, because those are the opinions that actually really matter at the end of the day. Whatever the mainstream media is talking about, whatever the corporate propaganda media is talking about, ain't relevant. Whatever we're talking about is. Even if it's talking about something that happened 10,000 years ago, it's still a hell of a lot more relevant than whatever the news is talking about today. Keith, welcome back.
We're talking about the Great Pyramid just before the break. And I was just basically going to reveal to you a couple of points regarding it that essentially are decisive in proving that the people who built the Great Pyramid had an Earth ellipsoid model, quite literally, they knew the dimensions of the Earth to the same standard that we know them today. And this was thousands of years ago. And again, it even reinforces this point about the significance of an Earth year change from 360 to 365.24218 days. If you take the location of the Great Pyramid, and again, it's something that we know with great precision on our Earth models, and you take the latitude of it, just under 30 degrees, but we know it very precisely, and you work out the small circle circumference parallel to the equatorial circumference, right? The small circle circumference at the latitude of the Great Pyramid, and divide that by the arc length, the elliptical arc from the equator to the latitude, that it gives you a value which is almost dead on 10 times the value for the Earth's own increase for its tropical year from 360 to 365.24218. It's a very exacting, this ratio. It's almost 10 times that. And the level of exactness is this. If you were to just shift the Great Pyramid 50 feet to the north, right, just latitude-wise, 50 feet to the north, the ratio would be practically dead on 10 times the Earth year change. Now, there are, in the elliptical circumference of the Earth, the polar circumference, you've got something like it's 131 million feet to the whole thing. And we're talking about a 50 feet displacement northwards, and you nail that ratio. And it's one of the critical things regarding it, which seems to say that was a defining ratio. That's why they chose that latitude. And again, you'd be thinking, if that was so important, then maybe it was a global civilization that built it, because they would have gone globally to wherever they needed to, somewhere on that latitude.
Yeah. That's pretty obvious as well. A lot of the discoveries that people are making, even today, ancient civilizations, huge pyramids and stuff like that on the seafloor off the coast of Cuba, pyramids in the middle of Africa and in Asia and globally. Everywhere. It's either on the surface that's currently there, or it's underwater that's currently submerged. Something happened to this civilization and wiped it all out kind of almost overnight.
Well, yeah, there are some good stories regarding that as well in ancient mythology. And again, although they are stories which seem like to do with gods and so forth, there's a high-tech physics behind them. There appear to be real physical laws which cyclically kick in, if you will, to agitate our solar system. And I'll definitely get onto those as we progress, because they're tied into resonance and what the ancients referred to as the music of the spheres.
In fact, that's something that occurred to me as well. When you were talking about these different planes of physical reality that were kind of not quite in with each other, what occurred to me is kind of like music. Right, when certain tones are played together, they make a song, and it goes ooh, and you can see it, you can feel it.
Oh yeah, this is the thing. I mean, you can look at all the different orbital motions of the bodies, the sun, the moon, all the planets, and so forth. All of them, they're all singing out their signature frequencies, and obviously they're invisible to the human ear. They emit each frequency. Is emitted by the planets, and they receive all others which rain down upon them. It's a very dynamic interaction. And the solar system is not just to be modeled in terms of gravity as it is, in a sense, crudely modeled. I'm not saying without precision. The solar system models we have, you know, as models based on motion, are very, very good and accurate, you know, and we can do a lot with that. But if there's a mechanism that modern science does not recognize, which is based upon this idea of music and based upon the ideas of the ancients, particularly, for example, that conjunction patterns cause great agitation to the solar system bodies, and this is tied into these cycles of destruction. If you do not acknowledge the reality of that, then you will always be caught by surprise when the day of disaster comes. And again, one of the things that we see when we look at things like these megalithic monuments, and we study closely some of the recent developments by our own military forces in various countries, we see that they are basically replicating the same ideas. They are building, say, military bases or signals intelligence bases. For example, like Pine Gap in Central Australia or the Menwith Hill site in Northern England here. They are positioning these structures relative to the Earth in the same way as I mentioned about the Great Pyramid.
It's a similar way to the way an acupuncturist would place needles at certain points in your body to balance your chi, isn't it?
I would say, yeah. That's not something I'm familiar with, acupuncturists, so forth, but people speak about an Earth, an energy grid matrix, and people do speak about, the fact that the Earth can be used as a means to communicate. I mean, I'll just go back to the Great Pyramid here. When we talk about resonance, I mean, one of the things about, and this is what you get in a basic textbook, if you will, if you've got a physical object of certain dimensions, and it's impinged upon by an energetic waveform, and when we model waves, modeling them in terms of peaks and troughs, right, as peak to peak or trough to trough is the wavelength, yeah, and we model them propagating through a medium. Well, if you get an energetic waveform hit a physical object, and the wavelength of the waveform fits inside a whole number of times the physical dimensions of the said object, it internally reflects back inwards, and you get these fixed standing wave patterns established. And they then cause the target object to start to go into a state of agitated motion, right? If the power of the wave is great enough, then the target object can physically break apart. And this here, this resonance itself, allows you to basically draw off energy. And if you look at the Great Pyramid, we've just nailed the practically, dead on the latitude as to why they use that latitude. But why is it built to the size it is? A lot of people may have heard the Great Pyramid reconstructed at 144,000 casing stones. That's a citation even from Robert Temple's book, The Crystal Sun. What is also interesting to note, though, is Its baseline dimension is 756 feet. And that fits in almost dead on 14,400 times into that elliptical arc length displacement from the equator. So you've got 14,400 as a fit, and 10 times that is the very number of casing stones. So it suggests that the size of the Great Pyramid was built to allow for an energetic resonant interaction via this displacement, this arc length displacement from the equator to its latitude. And if you look at, again, some of the work like Graham Hancock, when you look at the Grand Gallery section, he himself noted, when you look at the grooves in it, you're thinking to yourself, this had some equipment in it running up and down those grooves. Something was setting this thing in motion. It's like a nuclear power plant that's been decommissioned, all the high-tech machinery has been taken out, and all you've got is a stone remaining. And again, it's when you look at the work of Christopher Dunn, who wrote the book The Giza Power Plant, he himself says that this was the primary purpose of the Great Pyramid, to set it in motion, to tap into the Earth itself and draw off seismic energy through resonance. And one of the problems is, if you don't do it correctly, you can have a feedback where your device, i.e. the Great Pyramid, is destroyed because you have tapped into so much energy, you're unable to control its release, and it feeds into your device and destroys it. And he thinks that the Great Pyramid underwent some kind of meltdown, and all of the four sides of it have slightly looked to have been by just a few inches, just altered as if it's been crushed a little bit, out of whack, as if it's been affected in some way. And again, so we've got this idea that, the Great Pyramid here, we've got high precision in terms of its global placement. We've got the device is built to certain dimensions to physically fit into the Earth itself in terms of its displacement, all suggesting a resonant interaction with the Earth. So here is this amazing piece of equipment then. And I'll give you an example of what the modern military are up to and how they seem to have put some of their special bases in the same considerations. I mentioned Pine Gap in Central Australia. and also the Menwith Hill site. These are massive signals intelligence facilities. These are massive buildings, hundreds of square feet, with these, you know, the big golf balls, if you will, the radomes. You can zoom in on these on Google Earth and get the exact coordinates, right? And it turns out that if you take Pine Gap, right, and you work out the arc length from the equator going into the southern hemisphere to where Pine Gap is, the actual distance is 1,440 ideal geographical miles. Now, I'll just explain that. That is precisely a unit of 6,000 feet. And this is tied in to these ancient measures of minutes of arc, right, based on an ideal Earth size. And there's subtle proofs to that, and I don't want to get too much tied into technicalities, but it's interesting that the Pine Gap size is the same unit in the same numerical sequence, 1440, that's tied into the Great Pyramid. But the other critical linkage, and this is where you can say that the military, the US, is again trying to tap into the Earth. We use our advanced WGS-84 Earth model. And if you take this connecting line over the surface of the Earth from Pine Gap to Menwith Hill, it is almost dead on 3/8 of the Earth's equatorial circumference. In other words, the equatorial circumference, if you divide it by 8 and multiply by 3, you get the exact distance that connects up Pine Gap in Australia to the Menwith Hill site in England. Again, it's giving you this indication that there's a resonant interaction, and they are using the Earth as a means to communicate with, you know, these two sites in this separation, which is like a key, you know, fractional wavelength fit, if you will, into the Earth's equator. So you've got here modern military positioning their sites globally with the same considerations as the ancients. And you can even, and this is again one of the things I talk about in my book, you can even link the Menwith Hill site to the Great Pyramid. They tapped into the ancient matrix with their modern facilities as well.
Indeed. And isn't it interesting how you always have to re-enter the matrix in order to wake more people up? We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Keith Hunter is my guest. Ancient-worlds-mysteries.com.
Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand. Fukushima irradiated, and everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb to help the economy, while the prime sinister John Key and Nautilus Wall Street Bank of Wisdom sells off all our electricity generation and water rights to foreign World Bank affiliated cartel mofos. And the only one place in the New Zealand media where you will hear this kind of information exposing the scumbaggery, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Invite your friends, otherwise soon they might be sleeping with the fishes. And my very special guest, Keith Hunter, from ancient-world-mysteries.com, soon to just be simply ancientworldmysteries.com, as it probably should have been in the first place. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be here still. I think moving on from what I was saying previously, looking at the static placement then of some of the ancient megalithic structures and how some of the modern facilities by military forces seem to be built into the same matrix. I will say that what I then moved on to, because they're like static placement of facilities, I wanted to see if there was any energetic significance to, essentially sacred geometry, to the ancient measures that we use. And feet, the imperial measure set, feet, inches, fathoms, which is fathom is 6 feet, and even 6,000 feet, which is a unit measure that I term an ideal geographical mile, all of these measures, they are not arbitrarily selected. They are based upon the Earth's own tropical year, this value to a very exacting standard. You can derive them from that. And I was basically looking at these ancient measures, various mathematical progressions, right? And I was looking to see if you could demonstrate that rather than just have these measures being of significance, tying up the, linking the distances between sites over the Earth and looking at ratios of significance between sites towards the Earth or each other, I wanted to look at whether or not you could link them into physical processes. And this is where the big breakthrough is to be made, looking at nuclear weapons and earthquakes. And I'll just say credit where credit's due, because the pioneer in this particular field is a man called Bruce Cathy, who lives in New Zealand. And three of his books, The Bridge to Infinity, The Energy Grid, and The Harmonic Conquest of Space, which I do have copies of. I bought those about over 10 years ago now. He made a few critical linkages and really showed the way in terms of how this is modelled. And I did vary some of the things that he was doing. But the critical thing, if I'll just show this, is the issue of earthquakes, right? If you go to a geologist, they'll tell you, totally random, you can't predict them, they can occur anywhere. Right? Well, that's actually not true. They can be forecast with exceptional precision. And the earthquakes are triggered quite literally due to the position of the moon, the sun, the other planets, right? The configuration of the other celestial bodies relative to the Earth actually triggers the earthquakes. And it's this whole issue of astrology itself. When people say, do the movements of the planets cause natural disasters? The ancients would say yes, resoundingly so. Modern physicists over the past couple of hundred years would say no. In every age but the present, it was accepted that the planets, the sun and the moon, in their patterns relative to the Earth, could affect life on the Earth, especially triggering massive disasters like earthquakes. And it's such a high-precision science. And I'll give you the way you model it basically is as follows. We've got these earthquake databases, right? There's, in many countries, like the USGS, there's one in Australia, these natural hazards databases. And we've got monitoring stations. So when an earthquake occurs, with, quite literally to the nearest second, we register exactly when it occurred, when it first registered, and we've got the latitude and longitude. So we know the precise time down to the nearest second. You can put that into an astronomy package and literally freeze the solar system, right? And what you're looking for, right, we've got the coordinates of the epicenter on the Earth. Once you've got the precise universal time, a date right down to the nearest second, if you draw a straight line from the center of the Earth to the center of another celestial body, say the sun, right, that line will pierce through the surface of the Earth to give you another on-the-ground coordinate set. And you get this from what we call Greenwich hour angle and also declination. But you do have to modify the declination value from geocentric to geodetic. I don't want to get into technicalities of that. But basically, you're working out the on-the-ground position from a different celestial body, like the sun or the moon. And then you've got the coordinates for that, and you can look at them relative to, say, the earthquake epicenter coordinates. And you mentioned just a few moments ago Fukushima. This is a classic example. It's a brilliant example, in fact, and it demonstrates resonance at work. We know the exact time that the earthquake occurred in Japan, March the 11th, 2011, last year, the 9.01. We've got it at 5 hours, 46 minutes, 24 seconds universal time. And if you stick that into, say, the Australian government's database, we can work out the precise on-the-ground position of the sun. And its latitude is about 3.866 degrees south, longitude 95.94 degrees east. And so, again, I've got those very exactingly. I don't want to read off every decimal point, but we've got them very exacting. And we've also got the actual ground position of the coordinates of where the earthquake occurred, just off the eastern coast of Japan. At that precise moment then, if you use, again, our most advanced ellipsoid model, the WGS model, and work out the arc length connecting up the sun ground position to the epicenter, right, that arc length fits into the equatorial circumference of the Earth practically dead on 6 times. And if you do the equation, right, and you get the precise answer for the equatorial circumference of the Earth, according to the WGS model, and you use the arc length, as I've just specified, the answer you'll get is something like, I've got it here, I'll read it out, it's 5.9999929102, and so forth. It's that level of exactness. And just to put this in perspective, when we talk about earthquakes being triggered, we're talking about the sun, right, dynamically moving as a point-like position over the surface of the Earth due to the rotation of the Earth. In 1 second of time, the Earth rotates and the sun would sweep out about 1,500 feet in 1 second. And there are 86,400 seconds in 1 day. Now, if you did this sum and you took the equatorial circumference of the Earth, right, and you divided it by 6 and then compared it to the answer you get from the calculation, the error rate is about 260 feet or so, right? 260 feet, and in 1 second of time, you sweep out 1,500. It basically tells us that that earthquake occurred with split-second timing. The moment this resonant fit was achieved, in other words, the Earth was struck by an energetic waveform which fits inside the Earth a whole number of times, setting up the standing wave pattern. And this is why the earthquake occurred.
It's kind of like a spirograph in that sense. It's like a wheel that's turning inside a wheel, making a pattern.
Yeah, it is. It's a very dynamic.
Speaking of patterns, I think we have a listener tuning in from Pine Gap at the moment. Like quite literally, that we have a little viewer page map, and there's a regular listener from exactly that region around about Pine Gap. I wonder if it's somebody actually inside the facility, you know, who just needs their daily dose of the Vinny East, which I don't know. Anyway, tangent, sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, the upper echelon matrix, the minute you say echelon, well, Pine Gap's there, isn't it? with regards to the earthquake then, here we've got an example of the earthquake would occur on one of the amplitude points.
Oh, you know what's funny? After I just mentioned that they were listening in from Pine Gap, they just dropped off.
But we both know they've gone into silent mode now. They've gone into silent mode. It's surveillance in action.
I think what was funny is there, we were the ones doing the surveillance, or at least noticing that we were being surveilled. I don't know. it's still funny nonetheless. We're coming to break it about it a minute or so. So if you want to wrap up, go ahead.
I'm just saying that you've got this fit of 6 times that wavelength effectively inside the equatorial circumference of the Earth. So the earthquake would occur in one of the amplitude points. And they are precisely targeted, these earthquakes. There are more connections I could give to the Japanese earthquake to really nail it in 3 dimensions. But the point is, we can forecast with high precision, high magnitude earthquakes. And I'll give an example of that after the break, before I go into it. But
you're not the first person to be talking about this. I mean, we had a guy in New Zealand, Ken Ring, who was trying to use the moon's movements to predict earthquakes. Allegedly, the moon goes around. And you know how it affects the tide and all of that kind of stuff with its gravitational pull? Well, it turns out that underneath the crust of the Earth is all this liquid magma as well. And as the moon pulls around, that has a tide underneath the surface and can be linked to earthquakes. However, the predictions weren't 100% accurate by any means. Also, we have Sandeo over in the United States developing a system of earthquake prediction by measuring changes in sea level and temperature, which I thought was very interesting. So anybody who says that you can't predict it, I'd say, well, probably there's a there's a few ways. What did you say? We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose a sense of humour, you'll quite likely go friggin' nuts. My very special guest, Keith Hunter from ancient-world-mysteries.com. He's quite dashing like that. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's still good to be here. just moving on then. What I was just discussing previously, last segment, was the fact that earthquakes, they are high precision in terms of them being triggered by the sun or the moon or a combination of planets being in a very precise pattern, and you will invariably have arc length measures which connect up the ground positions of the various celestial bodies to the epicenter point. They will either be of progressions of imperial measures of feet and fathoms. If you scale up and do many multiplications on your calculator, they'll be of a basic set like that, or they will fit into the Earth ratio-wise a whole number of times, or fit together, different arc lengths compared to one another. For the Japanese earthquake, the Earth-to-Sun arc length fits into the one connecting up to the Moon through a ratio of 13 over 5. Just to give you another one. It's all in three dimensions. They can be very complicated, but sometimes they can be very blatant, like the Japanese one. But if there's any doubt then about whether or not we can forecast them, I would draw your attention to a really good example. If we go back to this year, 2012, March the 20th, right? And we're in Mexico, southern Mexico. For several weeks, and in fact a couple of months or so, leading up to March the 20th, right, the government in Mexico announced they were going to do an earthquake preparedness drill, right, in a certain region in the southern part of the country. And they got everybody together. It was announced. There's even newspaper articles all about the simulation and what the authorities were simulating. They got everybody out. They were simulating their response to a 7.9 earthquake, right? And they were going to do this exercise at 12 noon local time, right? 20th of March. I've even got a leaflet. It actually says, you know, it says Mega Simulacro or something. It's all in Spanish. And it gives you 7.9, and you know they're handing them out to everybody. Get ready for this drill for a hypothetical earthquake occurring at this time, 7.9, and did everybody out, you know, ready for this? Well, what just happened at 2:52 past 12 noon? A 7.9 earthquake was registered right in the same place where they had their preparedness drill. Now, it was down.
That's not an isolated incident either.
Yeah.
Christchurch earthquake, disaster drill during that day. They had 1,000. They had 1,000 soldiers there on the day of the quake doing disaster relief drills and a ship full of supplies.
In fact, ironically, this is one of the best indicators of an earthquake is when the government does a for a large simulation.
No, hey, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Exactly. I mean, that's how crazy it almost is. I mean, they had to have been forewarned. Somebody had literally figured out there was going to be one, a natural event, but because it's also precisely tied into the patterns of the planets, right? We're literally split-second timing. You could forecast earthquakes years in advance to high precision, stating globally the epicenter to maybe 2,000 feet in error, and stating what the time is to just literally 2 or 3 seconds in error because of the precision involved in the planets triggering them. And I think that going involved into, you know, putting everything we've got into modeling this thing, you need to write unique software to do it. You know, I mean, all I have done is a static analysis of earthquakes that have already occurred. But it seems to me that the knowledge is there, and the government does not want to, or the governments of many countries, they don't want to tell you that they can forecast them. Firstly, they'd be conceding that astrology is real. There's a physical science to it. The ancients, who said the planets, the music of the spheres is real, they'd be validated. They don't want to do that. But then we get onto another aspect of it, and this is very intriguing. Nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, amazingly enough, appear to tap into the very same mechanism responsible for triggering natural earthquakes. And all those arc lengths I was talking about that connect up the ground positions of celestial bodies to the epicenter points of earthquakes, if you just substitute epicenter of earthquake for ground zero coordinates of a nuclear test, say, you get ratios and arc lengths that are all interchangeable with earthquakes. And I'll just, what I did, and this is, again, it's in my book, The Lost Age of High Knowledge, I evaluate about 16 or so nuclear weapons tests, and these are the most prominent. I mean, I'm not just picking any old test from Nevada test site, you know, where thousands are conducted. I'm talking about the big ones like Bravo, like a 15 megaton, the highest yield atmospheric test by the US, or King, highest yield pure fission device.
Wasn't there like some kind of classified nuclear testing where they were attempting to set the atmosphere on fire?
I don't think that was. I think that was the.
Well, they were doing some kind of atmospheric testing, and they said, "Well, there's a small chance that we might set the sky on fire."
I think there's two aspects to that. In the initial scientists, when they were trying to work out the effects of Trinity of the first test, there was some concern that they could ignite the atmosphere just by that one test, right? But they went ahead anyway, thinking that it were unlikely. That was that. But what you might be thinking of is, I think it was off Johnston Island. There were, I think it was five in total. They were triggering the nuclear weapons up in the atmosphere, firing the rockets off, not detonating them from free fall bomb drops or surface tests. They were literally firing rockets up and blowing them up in the atmosphere. And I think this is some of the effects they got from EMPs. That was when it first started to become obvious what was going on in that direction. There were other suggestions, you know, about setting them off in the Van Allen belts and things like that. But when we look at the nuclear weapons, though, whether they're free-fall bomb drops or surface tests, they too seem to be triggered with split-second timing to achieve these arc lengths and ratios in the same way as with earthquakes. And I realize that is very astounding, but there's a great technical analysis in my book, and I'll just reel off a summary of just some of the key ones. I mentioned, for example, King and Bravo. They were both 1952. Well, King was 1952, Bravo was 1954. And the arc length that separated the sun ground position, if you will, to the location where these devices were detonated, right? If you basically take the arc lengths of the same type for both devices, the ratio between them is 3/8. Now, it's to an exceptional level of accuracy. It's the very ratio, if you do 8 divided by 3, if you reverse it, in an ideal sense, it's 2.666 recurring all the way. Well, if you actually use the declassified archives for precision in terms of where these tests were carried out and when the devices were triggered, and again, you use accurate Earth ellipsoid models, you'll get 2.666625 recurring. Again, you're looking at error rates of a few hundred feet. And because of the dynamic motion of these ground positions moving over the surface of the Earth as the Earth rotates, to achieve this 8/3, you know, ratio, it requires that they are literally triggering the devices with split-second timing. Even Hiroshima, a free-fall bomb drop, the bomb was in the air for 43 seconds. As the bomb's falling, the Earth's rotating on its axis. And at the precise moment the device is activated, the arc length measure, right, that connects up Hiroshima, for example, the latitude, longitude of the coordinates where the bomb was dropped to the sun ground position, right? That arc length there, for example, matches up to a very prominent nuclear weapons test called Mike to a ratio of 7/11. And Mike was the first thermonuclear device ever tested in the modern age, right? 1952 by the United States. So these are not just me picking and choosing. These are the most prominent tests going. And you can see the musical nature, if you like, of the ratios. And it basically tells you that the very same mechanism that gives us natural earthquakes is being tapped into to trigger nuclear explosions. And when we talk about artificially creating earthquakes, how would you do it? Well, again, you could effectively say the nuclear weapon is like triggering an earthquake in midair, so to speak, atmospheric, you know, giving the energy release there rather than be deep underground. There are all kinds of, you know, ways in which this science, though, can be extended, because what my basic theory of earthquakes is one of matter transfer. The musical patterns, if you will, allow for matter to be transferred between celestial bodies through what is known as a quantum potential. In other words, a lump of matter, dematerializes just underneath the surface of one celestial body and simultaneously is locally materializing, forcing its way through just under the surface of another celestial body. And if the duration of an earthquake was, say, 30 seconds, it's the actual withdrawal of matter at one portion, giving you a geophysical destabilization there at one targeted point, and a geophysical destabilization at another target point due to matter forcing its way in to a space already occupied by matter. And the matter does not go through intervening space. It withdraws locally and is transferred instantaneously, and then emerges locally. And it's that what gives you the earthquake. And all of the planets and all the sun, the moons, are all dynamically exchanging matter in this way. And this is very much like what you get at the quantum level when people talk about quantum leap jumps and some of the exotic effects that you get at the subatomic scale. These effects do occur on the celestial, macroscopic level, but it's not in an obvious sort of way. It's in quite an esoteric way. And I think this also explains how you can have gradual net increases of matter on various bodies and have planets expand. And there's evidence, I believe, James Maxlow has looked into this Earth expanding theory. And we're not talking about the Earth just maintaining the same mass and just getting less dense and expanding. We're literally talking about new matter itself being, you know, fed
into... That's actually pretty simple to understand, even at a base principle. Like, for example, how do leaves grow, or how do trees get their energy? Through the sun, right? Is that sun's energy already on Earth? No. So those leaves grow, don't they? And then they fall down and they become more soil, don't they? That's automatically more mass that wasn't already here on Earth.
I think you've got a point in some subtle way, but I think... When I'm talking about matter exchanging this way, though, I would also say that they are triggered then by the patterns of the planets. And most earthquakes do not involve conjunctions, but this is where we get on to the end of age events and the prophecy events.
Well, I think of it kind of like a coming of age event sort of thing. Like during your teenage years, you would have growing pains, for example, where your bones would expand in order to accommodate the new marrow, and it would cause you extreme pain and shaking and cramps and things like that. Similar thing would happen with the Earth, wouldn't it? If it's an organism.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the thing about the Earth. I mean, everybody says, you know, as above, so below, the basic principle. And there are so many things that occur in life that you can say that, I mean, our planet's not alive. In some sense, you could definitely argue that there are. And I think some of the physical processes, there was a Russian scientist, I think it was V.I. Vernadsky, and he talked about different domains of what he called, you know, inert dead matter as opposed to primitive life, like organic life, and then intelligent life. In the domain of the north.
More matter. Okay, we'll talk about some more matters and some more life after the break, shall we? Keith Hunter is my guest. Ancient-world-mysteries.com. And if you'd like to call in, the lines are now open. 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. Back in a minute.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go. You want to know what it's like,
gentlemen?
You can experience going to New Zealand.
You can experience going to New Zealand every single day when you listen to the Eastwood Show. And anyway, my very special guest, Keith Hunter, is here with us. And he's been on Project Camelot a number of times, as it turns out. And we tend to have a few Camelot-ish people coming on here. And by the way, I don't know who it was that recommended you come on this show, Keith, but thank you, whoever you are, because just lay down the mechanics of the show to people. I have to do everything. I'm doing the editing, I'm doing the producing, I'm doing everything, okay? It would take me a long time to list the amount of jobs that I got, and I'm not going to do it on air. So, in an effort to save time, I've had to cut out certain things, namely knowing who the hell I'm talking to. And I'm not joking about that. Somebody sends me the email in the name of a guest. You know, I'll barely even read the name. It's just email, click, boom, and then interview request, automatic, boom. All right, sweet, sent out. That person says, I want to, yes, I will come on the show or whatever. That's all that I'm looking for in their emails. And then they've given me their Skype details. They've given me their phone, backup phone number just in case. And then, boom, they're on the show. And I still don't have any idea who I'm talking to. That's why I start every show with, tell us who you are and what it is you do. Because I honestly don't know. And most of the people who are listening to the show at any one time probably don't know either. That way, we get to know very interesting people together. All right? So if you want me to interview anybody, anybody at all, you find me that email address, you find me that website with the contact page or whatever, I guarantee you I will send something off. What I can't guarantee you is whether or not they'll get back to me at all or in time or blah, blah, blah. This is the service that I want to provide. Public usage platform. Anybody can come on. There's no vetting process. Anything. All right? Even if you want to come on, if you're just an average person, you want to come on the show and just talk about some stuff that happened in your life. Never been on radio before. Seriously. Anybody who's got the guts to ask deserves to come on, in my opinion. All right, Keith, anyway, back to you.
Yeah, I think where I was going on to the next thing, I think building on what I was talking about before, about how earthquakes effectively, when they occur, they don't usually involve conjunctions, right? Well, what happens when we do have conjunctions? And these are the end of age events that the ancients speak of. I mean, for example, and they're not just in mythological terms as well. I mean, there was a 4th century BC scholar called Berossus, and he lived in ancient Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. And he was cited quite frequently. Most of his own works are lost, but other people have cited him.
His name sounds like some kind of bone disease.
Well, yeah, I don't know that the name might be a common name from where he came from, but he was very world renowned at the time. Although, again, unfortunately, he's only known by way of other people citing him. And there's a famous passage a lot of people cite, and I cite the same passage in my own book. And the passage basically says, Berossus says that when all the planets line up, such that a straight line can pass through all their orbs, and this occurs on the seasonal markers, like the Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, going into the, the equinox or solstice points, then you have great destruction either by fire or by water, right? And again, you can look at the work of Plato, and these key terms, destruction by fire and water. Plato, again, cites a passage in one of his books called the Timaeus, and it's all about the mythology of a story concerning a character called Phaeton. And Phaeton is the child of the sun, right? Literally the sun giving out the light. Although it is depicted as a god with his own palace and his attendants. And Phaeton, so the story goes, he goes to visit his father because he's not sure whether it is his father. And he asks the sun, "Are you my father?" So he goes to the sun's palace. And when he enters in, there's the sun, robed in purple, on his throne, all kinds of jewels and emeralds all spread out. And then there are right next to him the four seasons and also all of the hours spaced at equal intervals to his left and to his right, 12 hours each. And he asks his father, for confirmation, he is his father. And his father promises him, he says, "I'll do anything you want, within my power to prove it." And Phaeton asks to take control of his father's chariot to guide the sun, the light of the sun, for one day across the sky. And his father realizes it. This is the one thing he'd deny him, but he can't talk him out of it. So he gets his horses ready and he transfers the rays of the sun onto his own son's head. He crowns his son, right? And he gets in his chariot with his four horses and off he goes. And he can't steer a steady course. First he goes too high, and then he goes too low, and the earth is burnt up, and waters flow over the land, and it cracks open and everything. And basically, the god Zeus, right, the earth goddess, makes a plea to Zeus because all of the gods are thrown into agitation. And she says, if you don't do something, then everything will be brought to ruin and we'll return to primeval chaos. So Zeus shoots a thunderbolt at Phaeton and destroys him. Now, that sounds like a fantastic nonsense, but all of the gods are planets. And it's interesting to note the Russian scientists refer to the asteroid belt as the debris field of a planet, and they call it Phaeton in myth. Phaeton is this body that existed between Mars and Jupiter. And the planet Jupiter is the god Zeus in myth. And if you were Jupiter and you saw another planet cross over the disk of the sun, right, into like an eclipse, right, if that's Phaeton, then what happens is Phaeton is in conjunction. Now, you know when we have an eclipse on the Earth and we're looking at the moon and you've got the halo all around the moon, yeah, when it's all a black disk, that halo is called the corona. And the word corona means crown. So when this body, Phaeton's gone into conjunction, the sun god, the sun, his father, is behind him, crowning him, just like in the myth. So it is at this point Jupiter, or Zeus, fires the thunderbolt and it destroys Phaeton. And this is one of these matter transfers I'm talking about. Again, you've got these myths which have got a real high physics to them. And this is what destroys Phaeton. So you get an agitation of the solar system. All of the planets go into resonant agitation and it causes these massive matter transfers via this music of the spheres mechanism. And it's basically to stabilize the system once more. And you can get events which can either destroy planets or in some cases just agitate the system and cause a destabilization of the Earth's axis or the axes of other planets. And this is where you get into tying into the ancient system of measure that I spoke of gets tied into calendar systems like the Aztec 52-year cycle or the Mayan long count cycle. Their particular units of measure of like 1 day, 20 days, 360 days, 7,200 days, and 144,000 days, the Bacton cycle. The Mayan long count calendar is itself apparently tied into tracking conjunction patterns. And so you end up getting to the viewpoint that what we have are a series of patterns which can be established that, again, can be forecast if you know what you're doing. You can literally forecast the major conjunctions that will lead to these heightened agitative states and these end-of-age scenarios. And just to reference to the Bible, for example, remember the story of Phaeton, where Phaeton goes into his palace, the palace of his son, the sun god. He's there on his throne, emeralds all around. This is straight away from Ovid's Metamorphoses. Ovid's a Roman poet, lived about 2,000 years ago. Emeralds all around the throne of the sun, and all of the seasons and hours spaced at equal intervals. In the Bible, in Revelation, in the vision of John, John goes to the throne of God. And what happens is he sees God, he's got all these emeralds around his throne, it's mentioned in the Bible, and there are 24 elders all spaced around the throne of God. Now, there are 24 hours in a day. The very story in Greek mythology there is the very same story that we have in the Bible. And this is when we have got the end of age coming. And this special day has arrived. A new reign is about to commence, right? And there's going to be massive earthquakes, right? And you can look at the destabilization of the Earth's axis and days of darkness. And this is an interesting point. The whole issue of days of darkness. You see, there is a 52-year calendar system of the Aztecs, right? And this was discovered when, you know, the Europeans first went over to the Americas late 15th century. And in the first 100 years or so, some of the Spanish priests, they went around various places all around the Americas, Mexico, etc. And they noted that there was this special 52-year ceremony that took place among the Aztecs in Mexico. And what they'd do is they'd basically do a ritual sacrifice of somebody every 52 calendar years of 365 days precisely, right? But they do it on a special day of the year, every 52 years, when the Pleiades star group was in conjunction with the Earth and the Sun. They basically watch for the Pleiades at its highest point in the sky, its meridian point, right, at precisely midnight, right? It happens on one special day of the year. And this means the Sun is 180 degrees around the other side. And what they did in preparation for this ceremony is they'd extinguish all the fires throughout the land, right? So it's all totally dark. And they'd watch for the Pleiades, get into position at midnight, and right then they'd slam a knife right through this guy's heart, cut him open, rip out his heart, and then kindle a new fire inside his chest cavity. And then they'd light the fire. From that, everybody would light, you know, get their little torch, and then light up their homes again using this new fire. It's called the new fire ceremony. And what they thought was that if they didn't do this, the world could end. And they were doing this to, quote, appease the gods, right? Because their stories told them of a time far off in the distant past when there was a time of great darkness and the earth was violently shaking at the same time. And they thought that if they did a sacrifice, that it would prevent this from happening. And they were certain that at some future time, on one of these 52-year intervals, the Earth would come to an end, right? They didn't know which 52 years, so they had to keep doing this sacrifice, right? Now, interestingly enough, and I'll just throw this in, the current 52-year cycle that we're in right now ends on the 1st of April 2013, right? So it's only next year, only several months away, interestingly enough. And the mechanics of their calendar, basically, although they're tied into the Pleiades, the mechanics of their calendar for 52 years track bulk batches of Earth-Venus conjunctions. And it just so happens that this calendar resynchronizes perfectly every 6,028 years. And we do have a Venus conjunction with the Earth on the 1st of April, right, of next year. Admittedly, we had one also, a pretty good one, 1961, and we'll also have a very good one in 2065. So, but you get a very few accurate conjunctions occurring, and then it goes out of synchronization. And it only goes back into synchronization again every 6,028 years. I just find it interesting that in this era, we're getting an Earth-Venus conjunction tying in to the end of their 52-year calendar cycle. But this is where we get into this days of darkness business, because what causes all the Earth shaking is the resonance of the planets, right? If they get conjunction patterns established, then rather than just have a localized earthquake targeted at some point on the Earth, the whole planet will start to become shaking. And this
kind
is
of like a champagne glass with water in it getting shattered by a woman's voice.
Yes, this is an example of resonance where you can use sound waves to carefully interact. And again, it's all dependent on the dimensions of the glass and everything and its own natural frequency. But if you hit the right note, it shatters. With planets or stars, if you hit the right note, they blow up, right? If the power is great enough. But if it's not that great, they will just go into heightened agitation and globally they'll start shaking. Now, the same patterns that you can have, right, which can cause the planets to go into resonant agitation, can also be tied in to literally having a very exotic effect on the sun. And this basically involves the sun temporarily cancelling out its own light waves. So as a visible emitter of light, the sun switches off temporarily, right? You may have seen, you know, sound waves. I believe there's a company manufactured helicopters. Is it Northrop or Grumman or something? Or maybe McDonnell's.
Oh, I don't know. Something manufactured by some Blackwater-affiliated Israeli security company with ties to the CIA and NSA and, you know, it's all the same barrel of fish in that. And And it gets to the point where you're just no longer surprised, but you're consistently shocked. We'll be right back after the break at the Running Expert Show. To survive and fight for your right to part A. Just because there's a bunch of ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbaggery mofos out there who control everything and surveil you and watch everything you do all day long and try and are basically conspiring to kill you and rob every remaining freedom or bit of dollar that you got left, doesn't mean you can't have fun exposing them. Believe me when I tell you, you walk up to any aforementioned scumbag with a camera or a microphone, and some real nasty questions that you know no mainstream media piece of trash will ask him, it makes you feel a heck of a lot better about yourself that you actually got out and did something. Instead of just commenting to people on Facebook who you have no idea who they really are and saying you've been taken in by the big oil companies, etc. Keith Hunter is my guest. Welcome back. We've got the final segment here. My general final question is about self-censorship, and I'm starting to think that the question applies very little in a lot of ways, because the people that we have on the show don't kind of censor themselves anymore. they tend to talk about whatever they want to. But generally when you're on the in the bright lights of media or whatever with an audience, you try to mention some things and get out the information that you want to get out, and you sort of avoid other things because they're a bit too complex, and maybe people might not get it and jump to conclusions, might think you're a bit crazy or anything like that. So I invite people to say those kind of things that you normally might avoid in an environment with one of the most intelligent audiences in talk radio that I've ever conceived of. Like, seriously, I talk to my listeners every day after the show. They're real smart cookies. And I'm also very non-judgmental. I think that's why there's such a great variance of guests on this show as well. So if you have anything that you'd like to confess or something of that like, Keith, here's the place to do it. If not, you can go on and talk about anything else you want.
Well, I'm going to go on and finish off this last segment by, I wanted to just finish off this business about, well, Days of Darkness and how that relates to Resonance. And I was just saying before the break, there was a company and they did an advertisement in the US, and they've got some kind of like, you know, dusty place out in the desert with a dog on a porch. And dog's just looking at camera, and an helicopter lands behind dog and then takes off again, and dog's totally unmoved. And they're talking about silent helicopters and cancelling out the sound waves. Now, when you think about light waves, it's very similar. Light waves are longitudinal waves propagating through space, just like Nikola Tesla said, right? Only that they propagate through a medium which is of such properties and elasticity that the speed is that of light. But the same thing can happen with light waves as with sound waves. You can, if you very carefully put them in a certain phase, get them to cancel out. And one of the symbols in that we have in some of the esoteric texts, like the Gnostic texts, the mysteries related to the Christian religion, is the symbol of the dragon of the outer darkness with its tail in its mouth. And this, again, is symbolizing frozen standing wave patterns. And when Jesus is asked about this in a particular Gnostic text, and this is called the Pistis Sophia, which literally means faith wisdom, and it dates to the 3rd century AD. And it's a dialogue between Jesus and his disciples. It's part of the Apocrypha, not of the standard Bible, but more of the secret teachings, if you will. And he's asked by Mary Magdalene about the outer darkness. And Jesus says, The Outer Darkness is a great dragon whose tail is in its mouth, and that there are 12 mighty chastisement dungeons of the dragon.
Like Auron on, what was it, Never Ending Story, Snake Eating Itself.
I can't remember that one. Is that from a long time ago?
The Never Ending Story is like a 1980s movie with this kid, and he's reading a book and stuff like that, and there's this fantasy world, and it's being destroyed by this big force called the Nothing. And the little symbol that he's got around his neck is a snake eating itself, and it's supposedly the magic thing that saves the universe.
Ah, well, on the issue of this snake, this is a point about it. The dragon of the outer darkness, Jesus says, it has a ruler. It has 12 rulers, one for each of the great dungeons. And he says, the rulers are one in the other, so that if you speak any one of their names, you speak them all. He's not talking about rulers like kings or presidents. He's talking about nested cycles of waveforms. And if you trigger one, you can trigger a whole series, right? This is why he says they are one in the other. And if there's any doubt about this, Mary asks him about people who find themselves trapped as souls within the dragon. And Jesus says, well, if any of these souls came to know the name of one of the rulers of the dragon in life, if they find themselves trapped within and they speak that name, they throw the dragon into great convulsions and it is forced to take its tail out of its mouth and free up the soul. But Mary goes on to say, does the dragon of the outer darkness enter our world? And Jesus says, yes. He says, if the light of the sun is above the world, then it obscures the dragon. But if it is below the world, then the dragon entereth into the world itself, our domain, the cosmos, because the sun's light waves are withdrawn back into itself. And it's this temporary withdrawing of the light waves of the sun back into itself which is what gives us the days of darkness, the cancellation of the sun's light waves. When you get these special conjunction patterns established, you have massive geophysical activity, and simultaneously, the sun itself switches off as a visible emitter of light, because part of the effects are to cancel out the sun's light waves and get them to withdraw back into themselves. So this goes back to the Aztec calendar. They had a new fire ceremony. They extinguished all the fires because they thought that at a point in the distant past, they had massive geophysical activity combined with the sun switching off, days of darkness. And they were thinking they needed to restart the world, essentially. And when we have these major conjunction cycles, it's the same thing. There's a temporary, if you will, a temporary emergence of this realm of the outer darkness, which gives us the massive end-of-age scenarios and also the sun switching off. But it is temporary, and there's a great purification of the world. And I'll just throw in one thing, because I know we're coming to the end now. And I do have a YouTube channel, and I've just done a recent video called my YouTube channel is called Light Descent. And this video talks about an up-and-coming conjunction pattern that may be associated with a possible solar flare event. And it occurs from the 18th of December to the 21st of December 2012. And it coincides with the end of the Mayan long count. But the pattern is so uncanny in its similarity to the pattern of 1859, where we had this massive coronal mass ejection which wiped out the power grid. And it just makes me wonder whether this is possibly a pattern of great significance, but not necessarily an end-of-age one. Possibly, but not necessarily. But it's one that might have an exotic effect on our sun, and that's well worth looking at. So I definitely wanted to throw that in at the end, that there are real patterns of interest in the immediate future to look at. And we do feel like, many people feel like, we could be living in some kind of end-of-age event very close at hand. So I'd definitely look to the positions of the patterns as a means to draw out whether or not there could be significant dates. It could be exotic effects tied in to the configurations of the heavens. There's a real science that backs up this entire mythology of the ancients. It is very, very real.
Okay, Keith. Well, What are you going to be doing on December 21st, 2012 then? You planning on taking a hiking trip up the Himalayas?
No, I'm going to be drinking a bottle of whiskey, probably. I have to say, it's a strange thing for me. As a researcher, these are topics I'm interested in, but I don't think you can prepare for a pole shift. You know, I think the financial collapse will occur before then, most likely. So we'll have to see how that plays out first.
Mm. Well, during the first great inundation that they recant in Noah's Ark, there was a world war going on. Corruption and crime was everywhere. There was a massive world economic disaster. And then all of a sudden, stuff started going a little bit more haywire than anybody ever conceived of. Imagine. And they had about 300 years previously, before the Great Flood, an industrial revolution. Didn't we have an industrial revolution about 300 years ago? You know, it's like I say, man, in the end, everything comes back to the beginning. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And everybody's calling out for a revolution. They don't realize that revolution means to go in a circle. It doesn't matter. We've been through it before. We'll go through it again. And just like you, Keith, I'll probably be toasting the finest and enjoying the fact that I got to live. And very few entities in this universe really get to say that they truly, truly live. And thank you very much, Keith, for spending some time with me today. You can check out his website, ladies and gentlemen, ancient-world-mysteries.com. Keith, thank you, man.
It's been good being here.
And if you've got a spare 15 minutes after the show as well, we have a Skype chat with some of our listeners who might want to interact with you and get more information or even buy a book or something. So, yeah, if you're free to stick around for a few more minutes, we'd be much obliged.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. You can check out the archives in about an hour or two's time at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com/2012.htm. We'll see you again sometime.